This talk was given by Patrick Yunnan Kelly at Zen Mountain Monastery. Yunnan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. All of our talks are offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So, I'd like to start off with a short poem. In the morning, bowing to all. In the evening, bowing to all. Revering others is my only practice. All praise to the Bodhisattva, never disparaging. So this poem is by Ryokan. I'll say a little bit about him in a minute. But I'd like to just use it as a vehicle to examine a few things. Who are these others that he's talking about? And who are the others that we encounter in our own lives, in our own minds? And what does it mean to revere them? So let me just also, I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Yunnan. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm a senior lay student. I think I know most people here, but I have to shift between my glasses and I can't read with them on, but I can't see without them. Anyway, this poem has really resonates with me personally. I've been working lately for the last, a while now, as the Buddhist chaplain in a large hospital in Brooklyn. And so every day, this is my practice these days. I make my rounds. I have a few assigned units. I make my rounds, which involves walking up to a door, knocking, introducing myself, and basically asking if there's any way I can help. And once a week, I get a 24-hour on-call shift, which involves being in a small room with a little bed and then just waiting for the alert to go off. I sit zazen when I can. And the alert can mean many things. Usually there's some sort of emergency. So cardiac arrests, accidents, shootings, stabbings. It can be kind of intense, I often work with families of people who are patients. I was just thinking, I think everyone actually here knows what it's like because it feels very much like just sitting in the Dokusan line waiting for the bell to ring. And you know it's going to ring, but you don't know when. And you know you're going to get up and go in, and you don't know what you're going to find there. But you know it's important. Anyway, so there's a lot of encountering other people and all sorts of other people. I mean, it's New York City, so different religious, cultural backgrounds from myself. And then just trying to meet those people where they are. Often it's some sort of crisis, but even so, I'm really surprised how the variety of how people respond to crisis or grief or whatever it is they're experiencing. You know, I'm often have in mind the story of Kisugatami, who was a woman who became a nun. She was a contemporary of the Buddha. And she had had a child, and her child had died. She lost her child, and she was just heartbroken. And so she went to the Buddha and begged him to bring her child back to life. And so the way that the Buddha responded was he said, you need to, I'm going to ask you to go to a house and get some mustard seeds from a house, from a household that hasn't known death. And so, of course, she started knocking on doors and she couldn't find one. Everyone had encountered this. And so I sometimes feel like my job is to knock on doors asking for mustard seeds. And I keep getting the same answer. Anyway, at the end of a shift, as we change over, the chaplain who's coming off the on-call shift will offer a prayer or a poem, and it's mostly not Buddhist. There's one other Buddhist, but there's mostly, you know, there's Pentecostal, Catholics, Jewish rabbi and imam. So it's a real kind of mix. It's interesting. But this poem, I just found it. I didn't know it. One morning after the shift. In the morning, bowing to all. In the evening, bowing to all. Revering others is my only practice. All praise to the Bodhisattva, never disparaging. So, Ryokan, he's really fascinating. If you're familiar with him or if you're not, I recommend looking into him. But he was a Soto monk. He lived in the 18th and 19th century. He ordained pretty young, and then after he completed his training, he returned to his native village and established a hermitage outside of that. And he would just earn his food by begging for alms. And it said, this is from one of his translators. It said, he acquired his simple needs by begging. And if he had anything extra, he gave it away. He never preached or exhorted, but his life radiated purity and joy. He was a living sermon. He respected everyone and bowed whenever he met anyone who labored, especially farmers. His love for children and flowers is proverbial. And then I just wanted to say a little bit about this Bodhisattva never disparaging. I've spoken about him before, and I don't want to go into it too much, but he's from the Lotus Sutra. There's a chapter on him, but basically he's a Bodhisattva, and his primary practice is bowing to others. It said whenever he met whoever he met, he would bow in obeisance to them and speak words of praise. And he would say, I have profound reverence for you. I would never dare treat you with disparagement or arrogance. Why? Because you are all practicing the Bodhisattva way and you are certain to attain Buddhahood. And if you read the Lotus Sutra, he gets into a little bit of trouble. But he never turns away from that practice. But Sue, who are these others? When I say revering others or bowing to others, who are these others? We encounter them all through the day, from the moment we get out of bed until we close our eyes at night, and then even in our dreams they come to visit us. We're with these others all the time. Even in hermitage, if you've done hermitage, you know that that the others are with you all the time. And so we have all sorts of responses and reactions to them. Sometimes we love them, some of them we hate, some of them we ignore or overlook. We put them up on pedestals and then we tear them down from pedestals. We envy them, we admire them, we compete with them, we emulate them, we avoid them, we take care of them. Who are they, though? You know, for the most part, I found this in a novel I was reading, and it's a different context, but I think it describes well the experience of meeting these others. If Socrates leave his house today, he will find the sage seated on his doorstep. If Judas go forth tonight, it is to Judas his steps will tend. Every day, every life is many days, day after day. We walk through ourselves, meeting robbers, ghosts, giants, old men, young men, wives, widows, brothers in love, but always meeting ourselves. This really rings true to me. And I don't think it's this is how we go through life, carrying this self forward. And I don't think that's actually a problem, but that it gets tricky because we don't realize that that's what we're doing. So we're drawn to those who maybe resemble us or fulfill some lack that we experience in ourselves, or we try to get away from, or we feel aversion towards those who maybe bring up some part of ourselves that we're not comfortable with, or some person or experience in our past that we haven't really fully processed. And so we spend a lot of time, cajoling and flattering and bickering with and hustling these others. We're basically struggling with our own shadow, and it can get pretty exhausting. But at some point, I think maybe if we're fortunate, something shifts, and we see maybe you have a little glimpse of what's going on. Often that seems to happen when we have some sort of maybe contact with these sort of elemental realities of human life, the challenges. I mean, it's said in the Buddha's case that he met four messengers, a very old person, a sick person, a corpse, and then a mendicant. And that's what really set him off on his quest. I mean, he started asking, who is the one that's subject to old age, sickness, and death? So who am I, in other words? And often the teachings point out that we're not actually our thoughts, feelings, sensations, conceptions. We're not our job, our accomplishments, our failures, our social roles, our psychological characteristics. It's not that those things aren't important. They're very important, but they don't define us. In his, Bill Waldron has a book on Yogacara he lays this out very usefully, I think. He talks about most of what we experience as these fixed characteristics of ourselves are actually just habit patterns that we've built up over long periods of time, a whole lifetime, or if you accept the traditional Buddhist view, over many lifetimes. And we identify with these habits. And in a fundamental sense, this sense of self is the most sort of entrenched habit that we have. But as we practice and we keep turning inward, taking this backward step and examining this self and asking, what is it? Who am I? We come to a point where we experience this no-self directly, not as an idea. And I think at first it's often very fleeting. It's like, if you're in the train and you look out and you see something, pass, and you think you saw it, but if we persist, it gets, we start to see that this selfless self is the whole world. And it's not that we don't have a sense of self. We do, but it's more like it's an open window or an open doorway. And we see things from a particular point of view, but we can walk out and walk back in. And I think as we start to loosen our grip on this self, see the non-substantiality of this thing we call me, we start to see other people as they are, and not just as our projections. And what we start to see is that we're all in the same predicament. We all want to be happy. We all don't want to suffer. And we're all constantly imputing the category of me and mine to certain aspects of experience, and not me, not mine, to other aspects of our experience. And so as we start to experience emptiness of self, it inevitably comes with that emptiness of other. And as Milarepa says, the experience of emptiness gives birth to a heart of compassion. But I think it's not enough just to see this dreamlike nature of self and other. We have to bring it to life in the world of differences, of this and that. I mean, this is really challenging, how to enter the world without leaving the seat of meditation, of zazen. So I've been working with all of this and in the hospital. And this is always changing. I feel like I'm trying to hit a moving target. But when I try to just say to myself, what is it that I'm actually doing there? Sometimes I say, I try to be present with other people, whatever it is that they're experiencing. And that can be many things, like suffering, anger, relief, anxiety, gratitude, boredom. That's a big one. But it's not just being present. Also, there's an intention there, and I could say it's something like an aspiration or intention to be a benefit. But then I ask, what does that even mean? And in the fascicle that we're studying, this Ango, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment, Dogen says to benefit sentient beings is to help them arouse the aspiration to awaken other sentient beings before awakening themselves. He also says, after arousing this aspiration, you encountering and make offerings to and see Buddhas. You see Buddhas, hear Dharma, and arouse further aspiration for enlightenment. It's surprising to me, it's wonderful how often I come across people who seem like in a really difficult and physically painful situation, and they'll ask. They'll say they want to pray for someone else. I mean, it blows me away. And I think this, when Ryokan speaks of reverence, he's saying the same thing that Dogen is when he says to aspire to awaken others before oneself. But lest we think that, you know, we can turn reverence into this idea of reverence into a thing. I mean, I catch myself doing it all the time and becoming maybe, I don't know what the right word is, flowery, Pollyannish. But really, reverence doesn't have to have any particular form, just like so many of the things we experience. Grief doesn't have to have any particular form. And I noticed this, a couple, 2 weeks ago was the Gato Roshi's 15th memorial. And for whatever reason, I had been feeling quite upset with him. And it's funny, I still have a relationship with him. So I put his image on my altar, and then I did some prostrations. And then I started speaking to him, and I kind of let him have it. And then I did some more prostrations. And then I realized, you know, this is what reverence looks like right now. When we think of Zen practice, at least I do, I often think of zazen. And certainly that's crucial. But I've been reflecting that, you know, it's interesting, every day in zazen we go in to encounter the teacher for Daisan or Dokusan. And why is that? In the same fascicle I mentioned, Dogen says that the aspiration for enlightenment arises in response to the affinity between teacher and student. Nearly all of the koans, they're encounter stories. And the Buddha, as I mentioned, it was the encounter with the four messengers that set him off on his quest. And I remember when Daido used to give beginning instruction, he would say, every time, Zazen is not meditation, it's not concentration, it's not contemplation. It's a way of using your mind and living your life and doing it with other people. In the Lotus Sutra, it says, only a Buddha, together with a Buddha, can realize the thusness of all dharmas. It's interesting. I think this is getting at, pointing to why we can't do this alone. We need others in order to practice. People with different personalities, different histories, different religions. I mean, even non-human beings, insentient beings, we need them too, definitely. It's like these encounters make us larger. Or we're already larger, but we're boundless. But we don't get to experience it until we walk over the edge of what we know. And that happens a lot of the time by meeting others. I was speaking about the dreamlike nature. I was thinking about the dreamlike nature of self and other, and I found this, I want to read this short. This is from the end of a long poem by Wallace Stevens, but just these last two lines. It was really resonating with me. He says, it is a child that sings itself to sleep, the mind, among the creatures that it makes, the people, those by which it lives and dies. And I don't think he's talking about solipsism. I think the mind that makes the creatures, that makes the people, is not the small mind that's inside the skull. It's the mind of mountains and rivers and the great earth. And I think the sleep that he's talking about isn't the sleep of ignorance. You could say it's a dream of awakening, of this intention to awaken others before oneself. I was just recently, I had an encounter with someone in the hospital who's a very, very elderly woman, maybe at the end of life, I don't know. And I spoke to her for a bit, and then I asked, I said, would you like to say a prayer together? And she said, I want to sing. And I said, well, what do you want to sing? And I was a little nervous because I thought she was going to launch into some church hymn or something that I wouldn't know. And she said, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. And I really loved that. I think practice teaches us to be gentle and merry, joyful, if we really engage it, as we experience the dreamlike nature of this life. We come to dream a dream of awakening others before ourselves. So, thank you for your attention. May you have a fruitful session. May you arouse the intention to awaken others before yourself.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.